Welcome to Startup Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I've been SWB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, join us for a talk guest every Thursday night starting 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702. Or if you want the best online experience, you can go to twitch.tv. Yes, twitch.tv/SFU on call, and you'll be able to join us there and join the chat room and have a blast with the rest of the crew. Sometimes there's many of us, sometimes there's few, but there's always me. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter/X/whatever it's called this week account is sfuoncall. Also, I have a personal account called Paul Franz, PAUFRNZ. There's no T in that. And also Franz Games, FRANZGAMES. Again, there is no T in that. And of course, this lovely TalkCast gets turned to podcasts available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from ADB. Steve Petrick has just been busy keeping, working on the Orion Master Starship book. Also, this week, and found on the online store, is the Starfleet Battle Force Lyran and Hydran Playtest Pack. It's only $1, and that's because it only contains 3 Lyrans and 3 Hydran cards. Those cards actually looked really nice. I looked at them on the website, and they look really nice. So if you want to get them, you can get them for just $1. Obviously, actually, shipping could be a few pennies because they're cards. I'm sure they actually could probably mail them in an envelope and get you to there in possibly less than $1. Don't know. It might cost you more for shipping than it would actually to buy the cards. Don't know. But, obviously, as the ADB is pointing out, that shipping is going up. So, it is what it is. Moving onward and forward to the SOP Online tournament, that is Starfire 16 tournament. We have now 15 signups. We need just one more person to join our happy crew, and the tournament will be started. So please join us so you can get that last available spot. And when it comes to online client stuff, I did actually work on it just a little bit this week. And that is, I fixed the issue in Federation Commander part of it, which is not able to launch drones from the Federation ship. I really am shocked that this has gone on that long. It should not have gone on. I'm not sure how long it's been broken. It's been broken, obviously, for a bit of time, and no one's mentioned it, which always gets me concerned that there aren't that many people playing Federation Commander. And which is understandable, because I think most people like Starfleet Battles, especially, I'm not sure if you noticed or not, but on Facebook, there's been quite a few people who actually have been getting back into Starfleet Battles who haven't played it for years. Maybe they're finally retiring, and it's like, oh, hey, I love playing Starfleet Battles, and now I have time to play. Because, as everyone knows, Starfleet Battles can take quite a bit of time to play, and that's the whole idea of Federation Commanders, to take less time. And simplified, it's more modern in the way Federation, rules are designed to be, which is all the rules aren't explicitly written out. And onward and forward to more things. The library report, there's been no updates for either the SFB or FedCom libraries. So that is the news for this week. And it's me, yes, the one, Paul Franz, welcoming you. That's you. The Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we have Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Tiger.
Yep. Looks like Barry just showed up. Say, yeah, Barry.
There.
You doing? And last,
Okay, how are you doing?
good. And last and certainly not least, we have Doug. Say hi, Doug.
Hi, Doug.
So,
Hey, Doug.
hi, Barry. How
Who else
you
is on here? Doug, you, me?
Barry.
Anybody else?
I'm here also.
Barry.
Who's that? Who's I?
Gary.
Barry.
Oh, Gary. Hey, Gary.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Yes, I guess it is.
Yes. Because, yeah, Barry, you're rarely on these days.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was early for me, so I was able to make it. Because I've been waking up at 3 a.m.
Oi.
But I'm in California, so
Wow. That means it's
it's
around,
only six. It's only.
yeah, only 6:30 your
It's
time.
only 6:30 at night, so. Yeah.
Double checking, make sure my microphone is not muted.
What's that?
I just want to make sure my microphone wasn't muted because,
Can you hear me?
yeah, I can hear you. I just want to make sure I get everyone can hear me.
What?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Don't do that, Doug.
Yeah, this trip has been a great experiment to see how my Tesla fared for long term in the long term parking lot of the airport unplugged.
Wow.
And it seems to be losing about 0.5% battery per day, which is okay.
Agreed. Yeah, I'm assuming you don't have like the.
Apparently, I don't know if it's Toyota or Nissan, but one of the big Japanese car companies, they reported that they're working on a new generation of solid-state battery. And supposedly, if they can get it cracked within the next few years, it would double the storage space of the equivalent lithium ion, and also it would have like fewer issues, in theory anyway. But hopefully it'll work out. But of course, they have to actually see if it works out or not. But it'd be interesting to see if that does happen, and if they license it to other companies, how much of a game changer it might be for electric
Yeah.
cars going forward.
Yeah, well that's I think that's a critical
Right.
thing when it comes
Although
to electric vehicles, which
I, yeah.
is batteries and improving the power to weight ratio.
Oh yeah. That seems to be improving by about 10% cumulative per year, which adds up pretty quick.
Yep. Agreed. Agreed. Actually, I was
And
watching.
that's 10% capacity per kilogram and 10% dollars per capacity.
That's always good too, because bringing
So
down the
there's nothing
cost is kind
cheap.
of important too, you know.
Yeah. What's happening is it's not that they're increasing the amount of batteries, increasing the range, but rather you're getting a cheaper battery and a cheaper vehicle. So it's driving the cost of the vehicles down.
Right, which is normal when it comes to technology. Usually, you can reduce the cost of things as time goes on because you come up with better methods for creating those things. Great example of
Yeah.
that is TVs, you know, and
Oh yeah.
how quickly, you know, they've gone lower and lower in cost. Because they've come up with better and better ways of manufacturing, like the LCD displays that are cheaper and cheaper for the same amount of output. You know, because there's a certain amount of reject rate that you get, and the idea is you can reduce the reject rate, then you have, and then it becomes overall cheaper.
Right,
Because you're
right.
able to use the same amount of material and get more output. Usable
Yeah.
output.
Now, surprisingly, one of the things I'm kind of surprised at is there's a massive, like, 15-inch display in my Tesla, and it's super bright and super sharp. I mean, the resolution is unbelievable, and yet that display can handle sub-zero temperatures.
Well, I hope so. Just because
it
of
has to.
No, exactly. This is, and hopefully, you know, above 100 degrees, you know, up in the, you know, 150 degrees, maybe greater than that, be able to handle that. Now, operating,
well,
that's a different story.
They do have, yeah, operating is a different story. But the Tesla has a mode that you can put it in for cabin overheat protection, where it won't, you'd say, okay, I don't want to let the cabin get above a certain temperature.
Mm-hmm.
After that temperature, it kicks in the air conditioning. And typically, you'll set it to like 110 degrees or something like that. But you don't want to, obviously, you don't want to have that turned on if you have it long-term parking, because, boy, that would suck the battery down.
Oh, yeah. This, if I recall correctly, Tesla also has a kind of, what they call it? Basically, it's like a guard mode kind of thing. Where it uses the
Sentry mode, yes.
Sentry mode, yes. Where, you know, and that also will drain the battery pretty quickly, my understanding.
Yes, it does. It sucks about 2-3% of the battery per day.
Right. Yeah, I heard about that.
Which means that if I'm leaving the car for 2 weeks in a long-term parking lot, it might be okay, but 3 weeks would be, oops.
Yeah.
I'm in trouble.
Yep. Agreed. That definitely, that brings up a question for me, which is that, are there any like emergency charge packs that can be brought to dead EVs? You know, it might take a bit of time to charge it from the emergency pack, but at least you wouldn't be dead, you know, dead and have to get it towed, you know.
Right. Well, I think the vehicle, if it gets below 20% battery, and you never want to let it get below 20%, but I think if it gets below 20%, it basically says, okay, I'm shutting everything down until the owner gets back.
Right.
Tries to drive it somewhere, so at least you're left with some battery.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
But if you plan things ahead, you probably won't get into any trouble. So like, my car got parked on Sunday at the airport, and I checked earlier tonight, and it was still 78% charge. Down from 80% on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be fine when I get back to it.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah, it's supposed to get up to like 60 degrees tomorrow. So warmer.
Nice. So is the snow still there, or?
It's disappearing quickly because it's been raining. So the rain's been washing it away, and it's been above freezing, so.
Yeah, it depends on where you go. I mean, it's like we have a little bit out. We have some snow in the backyard and the front yard, but going for the long drive, you go out, and it's like mostly gone everywhere in Harrisburg.
Yeah.
At least where I was driving.
Yeah, I got out to California. It was cold and rainy, which was weird.
California,
I mean,
winter.
Flooding. Oh. It was flooding out here. It was weird.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. You had, if I heard about it, California had 2,000-year storms in the past week.
Yeah.
So
we had a very, very minor earthquake last night.
So much so that I'm sure Californians go, we had an earthquake. That's not an earthquake.
Well, that actually was me. For me, it was like, oh, that must have been an earthquake. I mean, it was that minor.
Oh, great.
Probably
great.
Magnitude 2 or 3. Yeah. It was barely perceptible, but I did feel the building move a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sure that everything stayed on the shelves and all that kind of thing.
Oh, well, no. It didn't move anything on the shelves.
It
was too minor for that.
Yeah. Understood. Now, getting back to the topic for this evening. One thing I've decided to do because of something I've never done before, and I think it's something that's overall, it's, I don't think it's ever been done. But I know we haven't done it, which is, actually, I'm going to go through the different space monsters. I figure we go through one or two, a podcast for a bit of time, and go through what they are, what's the special rules about them, maybe even talk about tactics to defeat them. Obviously, in some cases, one of the ones that I want to go over tonight is the moray eel, and there actually is a whole tactics portion in the monster scenario. So, it's less.
Oh, yeah.
What it tells you,
what was that?
It's kind of obvious, but, after you read the special monster
rules.
That's
what? Rule SM1 or something like that?
The moray eel is SM3. SM1 is what actually we talked about last week, which was the planet crusher.
Oh, okay.
Or the creature that ate Sheboygan 3.
Okay. The creature that ate Space Sheboygan.
Although, Barry, I know it's weird hearing Paul talking about space monsters that don't have people flying them.
Why is that weird?
Well, because, a lot like the Alunda space whales or the Branstone space dragons, somehow these space monsters are just doing their own thing. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, they have some automation rules.
Yep.
That were simple enough that they could be described in the 1970s.
Agreed. Agreed on that, because I'm actually getting this.
Well, in fairness, I don't know if you'd heard, we were talking very briefly about it too. I'll sorry to hijack your talk a tiny bit, Paul, but Barry, I don't know if you've actually seen some of the recent issues of Captain's Log, and also on Shapeways, they've actually expanded the range of ship types that you can get for the Juggernauts. So now they have a range of ships from the frigate all the way to a battleship. And so it's not quite as far as the Andromedans have gotten, but it's interesting to think about how a ship that's usually considered to be a quote-unquote monster ship has very slowly begun the process of being able to consider what it might be like as an actual empire.
Right. I know the name of it. What is it again? Say the name of this ship again.
Juggernaut.
Juggernaut. That's a juggernaut. For some reason, yeah. Now the original juggernaut was a beast. And I know they're making smaller ones. Do they have anything larger than the original?
No.
So the original juggernaut is referred to as dreadnought. They've actually made a couple of varieties of the dreadnought. So juggernaut beta. What the ship did is it basically, the AI on board the ship, converted a couple of its admin shuttles into these gigantic seeking weapons called shriek missiles that do, I think, something like 35 points of damage when they hit you. And then the Juggernaut Gamma, whenever it shows up, it actually is, basically what it did is that it converted its cargo bays into vertical missile silos. So we can have 18 shriek missiles. And it can only launch like 2 or 3 at a time, though. And after that, they basically added SSDs in various issues of Captain's Log for a frigate, a destroyer, a light cruiser, a heavy cruiser, and a battleship. And basically the battleship, it's 768 BPV. And it's got four phaser, 4 turrets. If you look at the Shapeways miniature, you can bring up a 3D model. And on the side of the prow, it's actually like an X shape so that it can actually mount all 4 phaser 4 turrets at once.
Now, how many phaser 4s per turret?
Well, each turret just has a single phaser 4, because the original one had the two side phaser 4s. It had, I think, two underneath the prow, and then it had two on the back. So that's six in total.
Six.
And then the Juggernaut battleship, I believe it has eight in total, because it's got the two underneath, two in the back, and then the four on the sides. And then it's got like a whole ton of extra. Oh, and also one other thing they did as well is because you might recall that the original Juggernauts Alpha had rules where if you shoot at a certain facing with enough damage, it'll automatically trigger the rotating shield to lock in that position for a turn. So Juggernauts basically figured out that that was a bad idea. So they basically removed that lock. So you can, if you as a Juggernaut player, can put them whatever way you like. And what's even more interesting is that there's a scenario in Captain's Log 41 where they show a Sartorian hive ship with its ship collecting a selection of ships in deep space fighting against a fleet of Juggernauts. And what the Sartorians had learned by then is because shield crackers are no use against the electrostatic armor.
Are
no use against the rotating shield. Yeah. So
right.
what the rules in the scenario let you do is they basically say that all the Sartorian ships have replaced their shield crackers with phaser ones. So basically it makes it not quite as bad in terms of like dealing with a fleet of Juggernaut ships. But it's interesting to think about how that empire, it's now beginning to become more of an actual empire rather than just a one-off monster.
Oh, okay. So they are turning it into an actual empire. Okay.
Well, there's been no like word about a threat file. I think it'd be great if there was in the future. But even if you see the range of the SSDs and miniatures that there are so far, you can see that there's a process that you can find there. So I definitely think that there's, like when you look at the Andromedans, I mean, it probably took a while for them to be fleshed out as a campaign empire. And even then, they don't work like anyone else in Alpha or Omega or the MC. They're their own unique thing even now. So easily you can do the same thing with the Juggernauts where...
Now, for the Frigate Juggernaut, does that have any phaser 4s at all, or just...
It's got a single phaser 4 in the front.
Okay. Which is still badass. No, I forget.
Actually,
other than the phaser...
Well, you can, the SSDs, and they let you basically, because the Frigate, all the more recent SSDs were drawn up after the Shriek missile thing was invented. So most of the modern SSDs for the Juggernauts, the different classes of them, they basically let you pay a certain number of BPV, and for each amount you pay, you can replace a single admin shuttle with a Shriek missile. So the Frigate with a Shriek missile or two is a dangerous prospect.
Yeah, how much damage does it take to kill a Shriek missile, and how fast do they move?
I don't have the rules in front of me, but I'm pretty sure they're speed 32, and they take quite a bit of killing. Even if you're using, like, microphasers or any other kind of, like, non-phaser, they're quite difficult to shoot down. Because I think what it is that they're treated as, shuttles as well, because... I think even
wild weasels don't.
I don't remember about that, but you know how, if you have, like, say, a short range cannon versus an ADD, if you're shooting it at a Tachyon missile, the Tachyon missile treats the ADD treats the Tachyon missile as a shuttle, but the short range cannon treats it as a drone. I believe that.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I don't have the rule in front of me, but I believe even a short range cannon treats a Shriek missile as a shuttle. So, again, even for them, trying to shoot it down is a tricky, But they're only one-off. So you're paying that point, and you get one Shriek missile for those BPV. So you better use it wisely.
Yes, yes. And it's immune to wild weasels?
I don't have the... I think the rules are in Captain's Log 32. Because there's one of the Captain's Logs.
Right.
There's a picture of Juggernaut Beta on the front. And because it has its own separate scenarios, because it only really fights the Federation. It comes like about 6 months a year after Juggernaut Alpha. But the parallel is the Sartorians who are in intergalactic space. they were calling their juggernauts after Roman numerals instead of Greek ones. So they had Juggernaut Primus, Juggernaut Secundus, and so on. But the way that the story is told in Camp 41 is that it's the same progression. Because, you know, for the Sultorians, like, when they went into Secundus, they've never seen a seeking weapon before. So they had to basically learn, okay, well, this weird missile thing is flying at my ship. What do I do with it? So, but,
What other weapons, other than the Phaser 4s, I forget, what other weapons did the Juggernauts have?
Phaser 1s and Phaser 3s, basically.
And regenerative armor, if I recall correctly.
Well,
yes, they do have regenerative.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So five of the facings have the armor, and then the sixth facing, even on the smaller ship or on the battleship, the number four shield facing is exposed, but you have the rotating shield. I think on the battleship, the rotating shield is something like 150 points.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something about the way their drives work that they could not armor the rear.
Yeah. But, you know, actually, I think it'd be interesting if they had bases that were like that, too. Because, like, you know how, like, certain empires, they have bases that are kind of self-portable. I suppose, like, the operations base of the Alpha Octant or, like, a Siberian mobile base. So maybe what the Juggernauts have to, the Empire has to do with that, if they want to establish a base, the base flies itself in and then locks in place. But it always has that facing exposed, so it has to use its rotating shield to defend itself.
Right.
That would be something that would make it different from an Andromedan base or from an Alpha base, or Vega base, rather.
Right, right. Because the Andromedans are brought in, they're towed in, yeah.
But although one last thing before I continue to further hijack Paul's talk is... I actually think one day it'd be really interesting if, you know how like in the Magellanic Cloud, the different levels of laser, they don't have a caster. You have to use the bank boxes.
Right.
Right.
Imagine if there was a space monster and it had heavy lasers instead of phaser force. But the monster had bank boxes too. So even as the monster player, you'd have to protect those banks so that you have the energy to fire the heavy lasers.
Require that the monster have.
I think it would be.
Yeah, that would require the monster actually have an SSD, like the Juggernaut, that kind of thing.
No, the Juggernauts have SSDs. Exactly. Yeah.
Right, and also dragons do too.
Parallel to the Juggernaut that had heavy lasers.
Yeah, space dragons do too.
So then you have to ask, well, does the Juggernaut also do the Juggernaut equivalent? Do you get it multi-layer shielding? Like maybe it has an inner rotating shield and an outer rotating shield. Do you do something else entirely to help distinguish it further from a Juggernaut, but give it some extra flavor? Because I think that actually be really interesting.
Yeah.
Because heavy lasers are good, but you only ever see them on bases. So if you had a monster ship that could fire them, then you definitely open up some new opportunities.
Sure. All right. So I guess getting back to the Moriel.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was going to. Just quick sidetrack, since we're already sidetracked, which is Shapeways also has space dragons, which are they're dragons. You know, that's one of those things that's like you can take a dragon, just add space to it, and oh, okay, now it's a space dragon. You know.
Yeah,
don't have dedicated Ramphodon miniatures just yet, but they do have more eels as well.
Yeah, they have a whole. From the looks of it, there's a whole collection of space monsters. I was looking at it while I was originally looking. Where were? I know they're here. I saw them. I don't see them anymore. There it is, monster. Right there. They have 25 of them going from like the small to the large death probes. You've got your planet killers. You've got your tarantulas. You got star swarms. And do they have it here? I'm just wondering if they actually have the eel. There it is. The Moray Eel. Let's give people an idea of what it looks like. Come on. And then I'll continue on. Okay. Da-da-da-da. I don't know why it takes a while to bring it up in the browser.
Yeah, the handy thing about what they do on Shapeways with them is that if you're only looking to get the miniature to basically represent the actual monster on the tabletop, and let's say, for example, if you've got the 7,000 scale Starship miniatures, then by all means get the smaller Moray Eel or Space Manta or Igneous or whatever, and then use it. But say if you want to, you know, play something like a Call to Arms Starfleet and you want to have like a larger scale, something to really kind of show off, especially if you're like at a convention and you want people to walk past the table and say, hey, what's that, you know, then you can scale things up a bit, and then if you've got the money spare, of course, and you can plop down the larger miniature and see what people think of those.
Yeah, actually, that's one thing that if you want, in my mind, if you want to grab somebody's attention on in a convention, which is obviously have miniatures, number one. Number two, have a space dragon or a Moray Eel, something that is definitely, they'll see a starship and then they'll see that and go, what is that? You know, why do you have this here? You know, get a little more attention. But moving onward and forward. Okay, da-da-da-da. The one thing I wanted to bring up was, okay, we're going to start off actually with the SMO2. Sorry, not O2. SM2. I'm sorry. I don't know why I said that. Actually, I do know why. That's the name of one of my the servers at work. But anyhow. The Space Amoeba, as actually was pointed out kind of a little bit last week, which is that the Space Amoeba has one of the more simplistic monster rules. Now, and which is that it's, you know, move speed 4, that is totally random. As in every single time it moves, you roll a die, and okay, which direction does it head? And heads one hex in that direction. So really simple. It's not affected by webs. Movement will trigger mines. If the movement of the monster, okay, this was the one thing that I looked at when it comes to automating. It's like, okay, I have to think of this a little bit, which is if the movement of a monster would cause it to enter the atmosphere of a planet, roll for a new direction of movement and continue doing so until it moves into a hex that's not an atmosphere hex. If it enters the atmosphere hex as a result of displacement, it will leave such a hex on the next move. So it doesn't like planets. Here's kind of the gotcha with the Space Amoeba. And here it is. At the end of each turn, the player must determine how much information is gained about the monster, how much damage the monster has done to the ship or ships. This is determined using the chart G41, which is, I think, it's an information chart. Making a separate die roll for each unit within the web sphere of effect. Now, scientific probes may assist the obtaining of information. The number from G41 multiplied by 2 is the number of damage points scored on the ship. So, for the amount of information that you get about the monster, it causes you 2 points of damage for each one. Of one, it's single point of information. The facing shield is the one that was facing the monster on the first impulse of the closest approach. Due to the special nature of the damage, shield reinforcement is ineffective, i.e., completely and utterly ignored. Big surprise. Now, where is it? Okay, a reminder that at the end of If you let it go all the way to turn 20, the monster divides into two, and all live points are lost. New points must be accumulated for each monster separately. One lab cannot accumulate points against two monsters on the same impulse. Each thereafter moves independently, and they will not enter the same hex if there's a legal alternative. So, now, the victory condition is, okay, the monster wins if the ship is destroyed. And the player wins if he accumulates 400 points of scientific information. I'm sorry. I hear that, and then I hear you take 2 points of damage. That means you're taking 800 points of damage. I don't think you can. What is it, you goofball? I don't think you can win that way. Use this information to determine just what will destroy the damage and then destroy the monster. Once he has accumulated the required points, roll one die and consult the table S61. Now, so after you accumulate the necessary scientific information, then you have to go to here. I had to look up. See, that's the one thing, that's the annoying thing about the electronic master rulebook. It's just the rulebook. It doesn't have the scenario information. And this is part of it. The S section doesn't really exist as part of the electronic master rulebook, which is annoying to me. But anyway, okay, here it is. If you roll one die, if you roll a die and it's a roll of one, monster can be destroyed by a suicide shuttle. Two, monster will be destroyed if held in a tractor beam. Three, monster can be destroyed by 200 points of damage from any weapons. Four, monster can be destroyed by a probe. Really? What is a goofball? Excuse me. You want to say hello to everybody? Say hello to everybody. Hello. Goodbye. Yes, the local Zinni is awake. Yes, he was very cute for those who were looking at the little thing at the upper right hand corner of the screen.
On that 2 points of damage thing.
Uh-huh.
Is that per point of information you gather?
That's my understanding. I'm gonna go back and read that again, because
is it directly on a particular field or internals or what?
Let me look.
Okay.
You can't survive. No.
Yeah, you can. If it's on a shield, you can just reinforce the bit.
Right, assuming that
you're not going to do it all at once.
But my understanding is that it ignores shield reinforcement. A roll of four, the monster can be destroyed by a probe. Five, insufficient data. You have to accumulate another 100 points. And six, communication established with the monster. It becomes friendly, and you're not required to destroy it. If you scored more than 50 points of damage against it, you lose a scenario. So that one's always a gotcha in my mind. Okay, back to here. Okay. It's possible that Captain's Log has corrected this or an addendum. I have not checked. I have not looked for the addendum. I am sorry. I should have, because here's exactly what it says. And then at the end of each turn, the player must determine how much information he's gained about the monster and how much damage the monster has done to his ship. This is determined by chart G4.1, making a separate die roll for each unit within the monster sphere of effect. It talks about the scientific shuttles and probes may assist in obtaining information. The number from the G41 chart multiplied by 2 is the number of damage points scored on the ship, actually on the shield facing the monster. Now, let me do this. Let me look up G4.1, scientific research. Yep, that's what I thought it was. So the chart shows the amount of range. You know, given a range, given a die roll, you then know how much information you've gathered. And you like most scientific research, it is done based on the closest approach of the ship to the object. Now, let's go back to here. Here it is. Yeah. And as I, the number on the chart, it says G4.1, but it's actually G4.11, multiplied by 2. So basically the amount of information you gather multiplied by 2 as the number of damage points scored on the ship acts the face shield by the monster. The face shield when the clip, but due to the special nature of the damage, shield reinforcement is ineffective, i.e., ignored. So, it's like, I gotta check on the addendum because I'm sorry.
It just sounds unnecessarily brutal.
Yep.
And a highly discouragement thing for people to play monster scenario.
Oh, agreed. As it said, the victory condition.
The flip side of that is that if you're going to gather the information, even if you're going to go in and do it in such a manner that your shield won't go down and you can run off and repair it, it would take forever. It would take forever with a cruiser even.
Oh, agreed.
You're talking about if you manage to take it on, all your different shields and you can hold it to 20 points of shield, that's still 120 points, and you need 400.
Right, agreed. And I said when the victory conditions themselves.
You play is true, you don't play this.
Yeah. That's why I said I read through this, I looked at it, and it's like, really? Kitty, I love you, but
no. I think last week I was mentioning that some of the more recent Captain's Logs have monster articles where they go into more detail about, XYZ to do with like a monster's interactions and so on. I'm fairly sure that there's one for the Space Amoeba, but I can't remember which issue of Captain's Log it's in. But if you have that, there might be more information in terms of like whether there's any errata about how the damage is scored relative to the lab points gained and whether there's like any other systems that you can use or something.
Yep. That's why I was
points negated by what system we use? Like, do labs ignore it? There's got to be something to make that playable.
Oh yeah, agreed. That's why I said I have a funny feeling that there's addenda to this because I agree that it may either we're understanding the rule wrong, which I don't think we are. Or there's an addenda which talks about this, goes, this is insane. Because it is. Because especially when the victory conditions themselves states as such, which is the plane must accumulate 400 points of scientific information. And according to rule, where is it? SM2.4461, that for every single point of information you get from the information chart, you multiply it by 2, and that's the amount of damage points that's done to the ship. And no ship can take 800 points of damage. So there's something wrong here,
Or it could be our understanding of it. I mean, I don't have the rules anymore because of that.
Hey, guys, I'm going to have to fall asleep soon. I'm getting tired.
Okay. Okay. Have a good night, Barry.
Good night.
Have a good one.
Thanks. Bye.
Or
it could be that for every so many points you get a roll on the thing, and that's different than the result you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it takes so many points out of 400 gathered and you roll on the thing and that gives you a different result, that might not mean you have to get 800 points again. I don't know. I would have to have the rules in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I doubt that I'll be replacing my set in the near term. So.
Oh, understood.
Which is I would love to. I mean, I had the full binder set up. But that's besides the point.
Yep. And just for a reminder for people, which is E6.0. That is the Monster Close-In Defense System, MCIDS. There's a reminder for folks that all monsters, well, at least most monsters, have MCIDS. And there's simple procedures for MCIDs. Number one, for against drones, roll a die one and find the result, which is that roll 1 to 4, the drone is intercepted and destroyed when MCIDs is active, and then or 5 to 6, it misses and the drone has not been destroyed or damaged. For against shuttles, 1 to 2, it's destroyed, 3 to 4, it's crippled. 5 to 6 shuttles totally undamaged. Now, there's limited targets. MCIDs cannot be used against any target not specifically listed here. For example, it cannot fire at mines, ships, asteroids, or other monsters or planets. And against plasma torpedoes, MCIDs works quite effective. 1 to 2 reduces the warhead by 35 points. 3 to 4 reduced by 25, and 5 to 6 reduced by 10. And accepted targets for MCIDs are as such. MCIDs ignores pseudoplasma torpedoes, so it knows that if it's real or not. Dummy seeking shells, it knows whether it's actually a danger or not. Slug drones, which is pointless. Seeking weapons not targeted on itself, i.e., that, you know, if it's targeted on another ship. The monster's sixth sense can extinguish them. The monster cannot communicate this information to another player except by the act of not firing or not allowing himself to be hit. So just a quick note there when it comes to Goofball. You want to come up here. Now he's trying to climb on top of my printer. So now, there is one thing which.
Paul, could you do me a favor and could you go back to that thing you were talking about, the damage procedure, mm-hmm. the damage amount that the Space Eva does to the ship? Could you just read that out one more time, please?
Okay. At the end of each turn, the player must determine how much information is gained about the monster and how much damage the monster has done to the ship. This is determined by using G41, the chart on G41, actually G411, making a separate die roll for each unit within the monster's sphere of effect. Scientific shuttles and probes may assist in obtaining information. The number from the chart in obtaining information The number from the chart multiplied by 2 is the number of damage points scored on the ship, actually on the facing shield, by the monster. The facing shield is one that was the facing monster on the first impulse closest approach. Due to the special nature of the damage, seal reinforcement is ineffective, i.e. ignored. Now, a note here when it comes
to... So what is the sphere of influence for the space in the event? How many hexes away?
For this guy? My guess is that it's the same as the chart itself, which actually is pretty broad. And that is out to range 10. Out to range 9. 10 is zero, zeros all around.
So basically what you're saying is if a ship is approaching the space amoeba, if it's not an Andromeda, because assuming the Andromeda can basically use its PA panels to, you know, park near the thing and basically try to gather lab information before it has to move off and do a panel dump. But for a galactic ship that has six facings, what it would have to do is basically on turn X plus one or whatever you want to call it, it has to basically face one of the six directions towards the amoeba so that the damage is done on that facing. Then on the next five turns, it has to basically make sure, because the creature only moves speed 4, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it has to both fire its probes in order to fill up the information. It has to try to use its admin shuttle to gain lab information, and then also does the scenario allow survey cruisers to use their special sensors to like help gain labs as well?
Right. Yeah.
So if it does, then you could basically spend those six turns doing like a 360 in the vicinity of the creature, and on the seventh and eighth turn or whatever, you can run away. You're not arming your weapons, so you should have discretionary power to be able to get out of the weapons, out of the effect range of the creature. Use that power to repair your shields, and then hope that the creature is not close enough to the target or whatever by then. Because the creature doesn't, the total remains running for the duration of the scenario, correct? So it's not like if you don't add additional lab points within a certain number of turns, does the count reset, or like how generous is it in that way?
And again? Sorry.
Like if you basically spend a couple of turns away from the creature,
mm-hmm.
using your energy to rebuild your shields.
Right.
Are you at risk of losing any of the lab points that you've gained to date?
No.
Or are they safely banked so that if you then spend another six turns doing another 360 around the creature, then you've basically gained more points, because your ship has the ability to get choose the range of engagement and also to replenish itself. Whereas the creature is losing out because it's got, it can't really basically stop you from building up that lab unless you're not, you know, you stick close enough around for it to cause you that extra damage. So, basically, I mean, like, how big is the map? Like, is it on a closed map or an open map or a location map?
It doesn't.
That the encounter takes place in?
Does not say what kind of map. Floating map. It actually says the floating map.
Here's the question for that strategy. Is there a limitation?
Does the scenario have a
skill box you can repair at that?
Yeah, that's the big problem with it, which when it comes to repairs, which is at the end of turn number 20. the monster divides into two. And it doesn't say this, but I would guess this might happen. I'm not sure if you go all the way up to like the turn 40, if you have two monsters, do those two monsters now divide again? Which would be,
that still means though that you've got 20 turns to gather your lab information. So that's 6 turns to get the first round of info, 2 or 3 turns to withdraw and rebuild your shields, and then another 6 turns to go in. So that's 6 plus. Maybe if it takes a turn or two to, how far away from the amoeba do you start the scenario?
Around 15, I think. It could be anywhere between 15 to like 20, 25, because the space amoeba is placed in the middle of the map. And the starship enters the map from any map edge. So you can be as close as like 15 hexes or as far away as I think like 20 or 25. I'd have to figure out exactly what's the distance when it comes to the corners to the middle of the map. I'm pretty sure
so that basically means that
I'm pretty sure it was like 20 or
you've got. So how many turns would you need to regenerate your shields enough so that they survive the next 20 points of damage per facing? So the thing as well is that bear in mind that if you are pointing the ship at the creature, even if you're within like a certain range, like 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 hexes, it's only ever damaging one facing at a time, and it's only going speed 4. So you just have to have your ship going at slightly faster than that and make sure that you're turning it so that the shield is a fresh shield facing. And technically speaking, because you're not arming weapons, at least not until you know whether or not the weapons will do anything, you can actually be beginning the process of repairing the damaged shields as you're using the other 4 or 5 facings.
Right.
So if you do feel the need to disengage slightly from the creature, you're not starting from scratch. You're basically, you've already done some of the homework. So it's just basically making sure that you're not being careless enough to have the same facing pointing at the creature at the end of each turn. So that basically means that you've got like, maybe you're only losing 1 or 2 turns worth in terms of getting decent lab information. So that means you still got about maybe, you said it was 20 turns or 40 turns before it spits?
20. But I was wondering if you get to 40 turns, does the two amoebas now split into 4?
Yeah, so that's still about 16 to 18 turns where you're getting solid lab information. And then that's also factoring in the amount of info that you might be getting from shuttles and probes, and if you have special sensors. But if it lets you use the special sensors, then too. So that should add up. I mean, it's like 10 points maximum. So that's like 180 points that you'd be able to get if you're lucky. Probably more like 160, maybe. And so how many points do you need to get before you can actually roll the dice to see whether you can, what you can do to it?
You need to accumulate 400 points of scientific information. Then you can, after you accumulate 400 points, then you can consult the table at that point.
And is the number of points that you gather, is it based on the number of lab boxes that your ship has? Or is it the sum total of information that you're getting? Because I could have sworn that
it's
amount of information that you get, is it per lab box? As in, like,
yeah,
like if your ship has 8 lab boxes, like a Federation CA, then you're gaining more information than if you're like a...
Yeah, those, right? The numbers multiplied by the number of functioning lab boxes. Yes.
Right, and if you don't have lab boxes...
So, yeah, basically that means that if you've got a Federation CA and you don't have the reactor refit for the labs, that's anything between 50 to 100... 5 times 8 is 40... That's between 40 to 100. That's if you get a range zero, which is probably not smart. But that's going to be, that's a significant amount of lab information that you're getting each turn.
Right.
Once you add it up. And if you're only taking, twice a single die roll range worth of damage per turn, then if you've got a ship that has no labs and you have to use your control spaces lab, that sounds like a bad deal. But if you've got a Federation CA with its full 8 labs, that sounds like it might be up. The calculus might be better, closer in your, more in your favor. So this does sound like it's a scenario that maybe suits certain empires like the Federation more than maybe the Klingons, because I mean most of the Klingon ships tend to be very light on labs because they prefer to have like dedicated survey ships with that function. So. I mean, maybe if you start playing the scenario of the Federation CA, and then, because I guess, I mean, if it was based on the on-screen episode, then that's probably what the default was. But that might be the best way to road test it on the client or in person, is to bring a ship with a lot of lab boxes and see if... that basically makes it easier to get to 400.
Understood. Yeah, you definitely point out something which I missed, which is you get the number from the chart based on the die roll, but the actual number of information points that you gather is based on the roll on that chart multiplied by the number of lab boxes that you have. So you should be able to accumulate the number of information points, you know, without having causing you 800 points of damage. It should be somewhere around anywhere from
range 3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you're at like range 3 and you roll a 3, then you get 5. So that's 10 points of damage in the facing shield. But that's also 40 lab points.
Yeah, well, so you know, 40 if you're on a Fed, it's 16 if you're on in a Klingon CA. Oh, sorry, Klingon D7.
I mean, I guess that's maybe a way to approach it would be does the scenario basically say you take does it actually specifically say Federation heavy cruiser, or does it say take a certain BPV point of ships?
Player must select a year for the scenario, as this will define the available ships, refits, fighters, weapons, etc. Y 172 is assumed if there's no alternate selection made. And also, if you decide to play a smaller ship, there is a ship size adjustment chart, which basically you take the BPV divided by 125, then multiply that by 400. So it assumes... The current scenario assumes that you have a ship worth a BPV of 125 points, which is around a Federation CA.
So it scales the amount of information points you need on the monster based on the BPV of the ship you're taking to try to deal with it.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. what you could then do is, if you're a Klingon, you could maybe take two frigates. Like, you're basically having twice as many die rolls, and I mean, the shields won't be as strong, but it'll be more, that'll be more obvious, I suppose. So, because that's the thing as well, because the creature, it says that basically it does that point of damage against every unit within its range, is it?
That's true. Okay, one thing, okay, just to let you know that I'm reading the tactics portion of the monster scenario, and it's it says here, your shuttles are can provide can prove invaluable. Klingon ships with fuel labs could actually gather more information with shuttles. As these shuttles take 1 point of damage per turn, they can function for several turns before they need to repair them. A Federation ship with plenty of labs could keep one suicide shuttle warm, quote unquote, warmed up in the bay to save time later. The shuttles could operate four hexes from the monster outside of MCID's range. That's one thing that I didn't notice, which was that the MCIDs had a range. But close enough to gather an average of 3.5 information per turn. So basically, it's suggesting that you launch all your shuttles. Yeah, it says it has man emphasis, it doesn't say.
I want to say that MCIDs is like only two or three hexes. It's something like, it's like a range of an anti-drone or short-range cannon, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get, well, as the name suggests, you have to get real close to the ship for it to be a problem.
Okay. Whoops, I missed that. Okay. I missed that part. Which is limitations. Firing the monster MCIDs can be used up to three times per impulse at any type, except on targets within three hexes. So the unit has to be within three hexes for it to for the monster basically to become aware of it, or at least consider it a threat. It cannot fire at a single target more than once per impulse, and the MCIDs has an unlimited supply of ammunition. Just a note, which is that if the monster enters the hex, can it contain a shuttle or seeking weapon by reactive movement? Example here is actually Moray Eel. MCITs will fire on those units immediately before they strike the monster. It will do this in every hex it enters during reactive movement. It will not do this during normal movement. I.e., the whole idea is that if because of I have not read you guys the Moray Eel. The Moray Eel is very reactive and very fast when it reacts. So if you launch a drone at like the, let's say the Moray Eel, it has a chance to actually destroy that drone before it, even though it's in the same hex.
Oh, actually, here's a fun one. Because you know how I think last year I was suggesting that one day we could pour through the Prime Directive source books, because you know there's some interesting stuff that they have, like especially in the Federation one,
mm-hmm.
where they talk about the history of some of the various founding species and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a portion of the Andorian history where it talks about when they first developed space travel. They actually ran into a creature that was kind of like a non-tactical warp version of a Moray Eel. And so they actually had to develop seeking weapons and impulse drive to be able to actually defeat these creatures. So it's like not only did the Andorians have to deal with a whole bunch of scary monsters on their own home planet, they end up basically running into monsters even when they got into space, before they actually made first contact with anyone else.
Right. I have to check that out. And that's the Andorians? Did I hear you right?
The Andorians, yeah.
Andorians.
Yeah, because in the Andorians, because it's interesting that even in the SSB Module Y material,
mm-hmm.
the Andorians are the only member species to use in the Federation to use a type of drone. But their drones, they're a bit different to drones used by the Klingons or Krasintis, because Andorian drones, they only have the hemispheric launch arc.
Hmm. Understood.
But basically, the reason why they have those drones is because they evolved from the missiles that they had developed to fight those monsters in their home system.
Understood. Understood. Okay, well, it's getting late, and looks like we were able to get through the first monster, and obviously the one thing I wanted to introduce, since we're going to be going through a lot of these monsters, is, of course, the two basic systems, which is, you know, MCIDS and also the S6.1 chart, which is, I think, critical, especially in lots of these scenarios, where a lot of times you have to gather up information about the monster to defeat the monster. So. Oops, did not mean to have that. But anyway. So, Gary, it's been lovely having you around. You have a good week.
Thank you, and have a good night.
Yeah, you too. Doug, always great to have you around. Obviously, if you want to, you can plug it.
Yes, plug. Gamers is in a few weeks. We're officially less than a month out.
Yep, that's true.
17, 18, 19. So if you got a schedule, stuff, send it to me, please. If you know what you want to run.
I'll get you that to you this week. This weekend.
PDFs and threads, discussion groups on Facebook and whatnot. So there you go.
Okay, we'll do.
Thank you.
Okay, you have a good night.
Mm-hmm.
So, got to be able to talk about the space amoeba, which is definitely one of the more erratic monsters. It doesn't have a particular goal in mind. It's not like the Planet Crusher or the Moray Eel, which we'll talk about next week. We'll talk about the Moray Eel. Obviously, it's important to understand about gathering information for these monsters, and also a reminder that the amount of information you gather is actually based on the number of labs you had. And also, you can get information using shuttles and things like that, which are, and of course, probes. It's always good to actually have a use for a probe, because you have those probe boxes and go, why do we have this thing? I never use it in battle, except for as an emergency weapon, which I personally have only used once. I actually have used as a weapon once. It's really a poor weapon. But when you're in desperation, that's what you do. So anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.